That's singer and composer Ravid Kahalani and his group Yemen Blues with Baraka from his debut album Yemen Blues, released in 2011, just 1 year, only 1 year after he founded the group. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is Tuesday, June the 24th, and two topics for your consideration today. In the second half of the program, we'll hear from an Israeli, the grandson of one of the founders of the Zionist state and son of an army general who was ostracized for advocating for negotiated peace with the Palestine Liberation Organization. We'll hear him explain why, in his view, Zionism must be dismantled. But first, I want to talk a bit about the re-engineering of President Obama. Well, what do I mean by the re-engineering? It suggests that there has been an engineering, doesn't it? And I believe there has been an engineering. You've heard me talk time and again here on this program about the fact that President Obama was shaped by hidden hands, presented to the electorate as a logical choice, and in fact it was a spectacular election in that regard, that those who selected him for election calculated correctly the impact that he would have in the United States and even worldwide. He had all of the attributes that would fire up the imagination of a moribund electorate, and that would enthuse people who had felt themselves locked out of the process, not just of voting, but the process of being a citizen, the process of having a say, the process of even psychologically feeling that one matters in the scheme of things. All these things were carefully calculated in the selection of Barack Obama for election by the voters, who gave him, as you recall, not only once but twice, a mandate. So strong was the, not just the appeal on one hand, because that too was carefully crafted and engineered, but on another level, it was a summoning up of hopes and dreams and aspirations that went dormant for a long time. People feeling basically that government was no longer responding. Government didn't care. Government was just a waste of time. They didn't seem to have much faith. And here was an opportunity and a person who embodied those unexpressed desires. And finally, of course, they became loud and clear. So he was an engineered candidate. We can't deny that. And to that degree, all of the candidates at that level are engineered. It's a major media undertaking, the selling of a candidate, so he's engineered. But when I say engineered, I also mean not just for marketing purposes. I mean engineered as the agent through which major objectives, aims and objectives would be accomplished, that the power elite and only the power elite are in a position to call. They define it, they present their list of particulars, their bill of particulars to the administration, whoever the candidate happens to be, whoever the president happens to be, and it is understood that they have the wherewithal to make their desires and their wants and their objectives to get them met. They have a ready and willing listening ear at the White House. I talked about the fact that President Obama clearly did not understand, nor did his people understand that there's a difference between a constituency and a political base. But in this particular president, we find that he has alienated himself from both, because in the end, that small hope that people were holding on to, that yes, we know that he could not have gotten that far. He couldn't, this meteoric rise through the ranks of the Democratic Party and into the White House through an incredibly well-organized and well-run election, that couldn't happen without somebody calling the shots. He didn't do that. But there was a hope that just the same, there would be a portion of Barack Obama that would have remained uniquely his own self, his true self, his unassailable self. And we haven't found it. It has not evidenced itself. Let me put it that way. It has not made itself clear that he is a man on his own, able to make decisions, able to call the shots, able to compel people to do things he wants done. You get a sense from this president that it's all choreographed for him. All he has to do is to fulfill his preordained, predestined role, which is simply, you know, as I say, it's just show up and do this. Show up and make a speech here. Show up and, you know, make a speech there and make statements and do fundraising and all these kinds of things. But, you know, since this situation in Iraq has erupted, and it was already in momentum, but the situation in Iraq has a kind of added fuel to this fire. And you see now the undeniable evidence that the president is being re-engineered again. And this time for his exit. The question is, what will he be allowed to do before his exit, between now and the time that he makes his exit? How much of that will be his will, and how much of that essentially is going to be, again, the standing order, which is these hidden hands calling the shots and him just doing their bidding? It sounds awful. I'm almost embarrassed to talk about it this way, but that is the reality from the way I see it. I just can't see it any other way, that this president has missed out on so many years and so many opportunities to make clear that he does have a vision and he does have the strength and he does have the faith in the support that he has in the electorate, the people who put him in office, not once, but twice, that he, on the basis of these things, he's able to accomplish things that are long yearned for. But I liken it to the experience in New York City when David Dinkins, the first African-American elected to office as mayor. And for the entire time that he was in office, he was essentially innocuous. There was nothing particularly memorable about his administration, because from the word go, he had volunteered himself as a hostage to the interests that ran the city and therefore ran him and ran his administration. President Obama has been consigned, and you look at the way the media are treating him too, media outlets have understood this message, and they're carrying out their leg of the race right now. They have marginalized him. He's not front and center of decisions. He's not front and center of policies. He is there simply to absorb the flak. He's the flak catcher right now. He's the person who is to be targeted with failures, to account for the failures of his administration. And the people doing the heavy lifting are people like Kerry and others in his administration who are the experts. They have come to the fore and they are carrying the load, the heavy load, and the president is basically consigned ever so increasingly to the periphery of our consciousness. He's there as a prop. He's there to react to things. He's there to call, to be called on to account. This is also the way he's seen on the world stage. I mean, Vladimir Putin is not impressed by Barack Obama. He's impressed by the people who run Obama, but he's not in any way intimidated or impressed by Obama at all. The Chinese are not impressed by Obama either. They're impressed by the people who run him. So when he gets up and the president gets up and makes these statements about what will be allowed, well, yeah, I understand, oh, there he goes again, you know, he's just talking. But he's not to be paid attention to, because his administration has been rendered basically ineffective. The Congress, for reasons that are deeply rooted in race and racist beliefs and values, have successfully stymied any movement in Congress. But that says as much about them as it does about the bad judgment of the president. This president should have come in like a warrior with a full complement of fellow warriors who were clear about a mission which he would have called and designed and enumerated, and whose job it would have been to get that ball into the end zone. That's if you're serious, and that's if you really are calling your shots. You surround yourself with people who are fighters. You surround yourself with people who know what they're doing and how to get things done. You surround yourself with people who understand that there is a charge here, literally, to make history, other than the history already made, but to make history as a significant step forward in the progress of a nation on so many levels. You come in with that kind of a battalion around you, and you are ready for a fight. You're ready to do business. You're tapping into all of the experience and expertise that they have to get things done. But of course, his administration from the beginning was entrepreneurial in nature. People came on board because they had their plans, they had their ambitions, and the only use that they had for Barack Obama was to get elected so that they can be put into the spots that they coveted so as to achieve their private agendas. They've done remarkably well. And the people he selected were literally people who were in a position to call their shots. Hillary Clinton says, "I am going to be Secretary of State." What a joy that has been. And we have, of course, a Secretary of Education, my favorite member of cabinet, completely unqualified for the job. We have ambassadors chosen who have no idea, who couldn't point out the countries that they are assigned to on a map. We have corporate America and the moneyed elite running things. We have people who suddenly find themselves heading the Fed and controlling the banking system of our nation, who just the other day were doing something just mildly related, but today are in charge. So he has been extremely amenable to being engineered, to serving the purpose of these, I call them hidden hands. And on the international level, what has happened in the meantime is that he and his administration, the Obama administration, isn't really scaring anybody. The United States isn't scaring anybody, because people have pulled back the curtain and they see what it is. It's a lot of talk. It's certainly the United States has the power to do a lot of damage. It's got all the toys of war. But in fact, the moral fiber of the United States doesn't exist. And this is the message that this crisis in Iraq is bringing home in stark reality. The United States finally is seen in so many quarters of the earth as being bereft of moral fiber. It has therefore forfeited the right to call the shots on moral grounds in the world. And there is a growing sentiment that there is no need to be afraid of what the United States would do. It has already, in so many instances, the United States has demonstrated its capacity for major violence. That is already established. And it doesn't thwart resistors. It has not caused people to rethink what they will do. So in this sense, the president and his presidency are being re-engineered again, because the United States and the world, we are on the cusp of an extraordinary period of time when things will change dramatically. Of course, we have the midterms already occurring in the United States. We have the fight over who will control the House and Congress, and that is essentially a fight to determine the fate of the duopoly. But we know that there will still be, when it's all said and done, there will be a duopoly. There will be no new entrants into this fight. We will have still the Republicans and the Democrats. The only question is how much of the spoils will each party have. But it's going to be important, because they still will get to call the shots as to who controls legislation in the House, who will control legislation in the Congress. We have the presidential elections around the corner, 2016, and we know that that is the coveted prize. We know that people are already jockeying for the public's attention and for indications as to whether they can count on the faithful to deliver, whether they still have the goods. But something else is occurring in the United States around the corner and in the not-too-distant future, in the year 2043, when this nation will no longer be a majority white nation. 14 states already have tilted to majority-minority status. And here we have, therefore, a signal to those who understand what this means, these powers that be that have thrived because of our system of apartheid, that there is to be a realignment of interests, so that by the year 2043, if outnumbered, numerically, they still will have control of the economy. There still will be control of legislatures across the country. There still will be control of the so-called national identity. So all of these things are happening. And in that transition, President Obama and his administration will have also to serve a role. And that role would be to be a kind of watermark, a milestone. You know, the way you have AD and BC, or the other way around, BC and AD, the division of time, it would be America before Obama, America after Obama. And what's happening now is that re-engineering to fill that gap between before Obama and after Obama, so that after Obama, there would be a returning to the old ways. I mean, in full form. The sad part of it is that this president has cooperated with it all along and continues to cooperate with it. So there's much work to do. I want to switch now to our instruction for the day, coming from Mikko Peled, who was born in Jerusalem to a prominent Zionist family. He is the grandson of one of the signers of the establishment of the Zionist state. He is the son of an army general who also went to Israel, heeding the call of Zionism, and who later became very, very disturbed about the concept of Zionism and the philosophy of Zionism and the practice of Zionism in the form of policies, and began to speak out against it, and so was ostracized. He's talking here, he's discussing from his vantage point why Zionism must be dismantled. And why this is instructive is that one of the hidden pieces of the puzzle as this ISIS crisis unfolds in Iraq and in the region, we hear very little, comparatively speaking, about the role of Israel, except that, of course, Benjamin Netanyahu has always encouraged the United States to be fierce and to retaliate and with full force against the acts of terrorism and against terrorism itself. And you will recall the spectacular appeals he made at the United Nations with this point, and his even coming to the United States and in bold fashion upbraiding the president about his apparent lack of enthusiasm to inflict maximum punishment. But listen to this story and listen to his explanation, because it is quite instructive. By the way, this comes just this past week in Detroit. The Presbyterian Church gathered, as it does for its General Assembly, and voted to withhold their investments from businesses that are located in what they consider to be occupied Palestinian territory. This is part of the boycott, divest, sanctions movement, or the BDS movement, urging organizations and individuals to rethink their investment in Israel with respect to the treatment of the Palestinians and the occupation of their territory, much like the movement that was initiated during apartheid in South Africa. So with that, I want to share with you these observations by Miko Peled. We hear him now.
Captivated audience. The book was written because there was a story that had to be told, and there was a need for clarification on an issue that has captivated audiences around the world for the last 65, 70 years. The book is titled "The General's Son: Journey of an Israeli in Palestine," and that demonstrates or represents the two aspects of the book and the two aspects of the story to which I was witness. So the first part is my being the son of a general and what that means as an Israeli, being the son of an Israeli general. And the second part is the discovery of Palestine and my journey into Palestine, or the journey into Palestine, as an Israeli. And the book touches on all the major hot button issues that touch on the state of Israel as an entity, and also the Israeli-Palestinian issue with the two entities, Israelis and Palestinians, together. These issues are Zionism, the justification for Zionism, the justification for the immigration of Jews, and my grandparents represent that. My grandparents came to Palestine as immigrants, and the story of that generation, and then the story of my parents, the generation that fought in 1948, that was already born in Palestine, this new Zionist, or the first Zionists that were born in Palestine, and then the war of 1967, the issue of the peace process, the issue of terrorism, and then where do we go from here, the issue of how do we move forward in light of all of that. The reason there's been so much, or there's been this much interest in the book and in the story, is because it clarifies a lot of issues about which people are still confused. For example, if we, in the common discourse in the West, the issue of Zionism, or Zionism as an ideology, has completely come to be accepted, which means that the claim that Jewish people, because they are the descendants of the ancient Hebrews, have a right to go and live in Palestine, and the word that is used is to return. And it's become quite acceptable to say Jewish people have a right to return to their homeland, even though there's not a single Jewish person alive who can trace their heritage back to the ancient Hebrews, who lived there some 2,000-3,000 years ago. Yet when we talk about the return of Palestinians, who were forced out of their homes only 65 years ago, many of them are still alive and have the keys to their home, that right to return is denied. And this is very confusing to many people. It's a double standard that people don't understand, and it's hard to explain, it's hard to justify. And the only way to justify it is through mythology and double standard. And this book kind of sheds light on this issue. And then the war of 1948, at the end of which two things happened. The Jewish state was created, the state of Israel was created, which, again, in the discourse is very justified and seen in very heroic light. But on the other hand, you had hundreds of thousands of people who became refugees, close to 1 million Palestinian refugees. And how do you bridge that? How do you see, on the one hand, this act of so-called heroism and the rebirth of the Jewish people in their own homeland, and on the other hand, you have the story of the refugees, and in many ways these two stories contradict. People argue over the actual facts. The issue of 1948 is an interesting one. My father was a young officer during those days. And again, growing up as an Israeli, this was an act of heroism. I was very proud of that. However, when we look at the details, when we take a look at what actually took place, if we, you know, allow ourselves to go beyond the myth, then we can see that everything that took place is not exactly as we are told. What we are told is, for example, the Arabs attacked the small Jewish community in order to destroy them. The Arabs rejected the partition plan, the 1947 partition plan. And all these things are seen as just fact and reality. When we look at the partition plan, for example, why would anybody have accepted it? Why should the Palestinians have accepted that their land was cut off and the bigger portion of it given to a small group of immigrants, you know, less than 500,000 or so immigrants who had just arrived, basically, in Palestine, while the Palestinian Arab population was far greater? So why should have they accepted it? Then if we talk about the attack, the so-called attack of the Arabs, and we take a look, we see that the Zionist community, the Jewish community at the time, already had a very massive, very strong militia. There was no militia on the Palestinian side. In fact, there was no Palestinian army. Arab forces intervened in Palestine much later on, 6-7 months later. So you have to wonder, if this is true, who attacked the Jewish community? And once again, now historians have confirmed what Palestinians have been saying for almost 7 decades, that it was the Zionist militias that initiated a massive attack, a massive terrorist attack, at the end of which almost 1 million people were forced to leave their home. It was an ethnic cleansing campaign. Now, this whole story I see from, or I describe from the historical perspective, but also from the story of my parents, my father who fought in 1948, my mother who lived in Jerusalem and was offered a home, a Palestinian home in Jerusalem, after the Palestinian community was forced to leave, homes and neighborhoods in West Jerusalem that are still there, and she refused to accept the home, and she told me this story many, many times as I was growing up. I relate in the book, not just because it's a good story, but because there's something very unique, about the story and her point of view. She was a young mother, her husband was fighting in the front, she was offered a beautiful home for free, and she said no. And beyond that, she used to always tell me that this was wrong. You know, she used to say, how could I possibly live in somebody else's home knowing that they're now in exile? And this, of course, contradicted the national narrative, because if the national narrative was true, then what's wrong with taking the home? If the Arabs attacked us, if they left of their own free will, as the narrative claims, then there's nothing wrong with taking the home. So this was the backdrop for that era. Then we approach 1967, and the war of 1967, once again, the story says that we the Israelis, were attacked, we were under an existential threat. Yet my father, who was a general at the time, claimed that the war was a war of choice. As I was working on the book and I went into the Israeli archives, I saw the minutes of the meetings of the generals leading up to the war, and they all talk about an opportunity, not a threat. Particularly when we talk about the Egyptian, the war with Egypt, which is how the whole conflict began. So they say the fact that the Egyptian army entered forces into the Sinai Peninsula, while it's considered an act of war because it was in violation of the ceasefire agreement, was an opportunity. It made it easier for the Israeli army to destroy them. They were confident of their victory, and in fact, they claimed the Egyptian army was not really prepared for war. So you've got the myth and you've got the reality, and Israelis have made no secret of the fact that this was the reality. It's just that after the fact, they began developing this myth of the existential threat. Another thing that comes out is that Israel had always wanted to take the West Bank, particularly the military. They always thought that taking the West Bank was an important part of the mission. And so they did so in 1967, and the job was done, and the job was taking Palestine back and giving it, or taking the land of Israel back and giving it to the Jewish people. And in the book, I describe this in very personal terms, things that my father said, things that I'd heard growing up, and then again, using the historical documentation. The next point that is, you know, like I said, one of these red hot button issues is the issue of the peace process. At the end of the war, my father claimed that it was Israel needed to make peace with the Palestinians and allow them to establish a state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. This was the late 60s. During the 70s and 80s, he dedicated himself to that end, meeting with PLO representatives, meeting with Yasser Arafat. And the claim was always that the Palestinians don't want peace, the Palestinians are terrorists, and Israel, of course, as a state, would have nothing to do with this, even though major Palestinian figures had invested in putting this plan together, the two-state solution. And then in 1993, you have to wonder what happened. Suddenly the Oslo Peace Accord came about. And when we take a look at what happened by 1993, why Israel was suddenly willing to meet with the PLO and meet with Yasser Arafat, it's because they had already made certain that there could not be a Palestinian state. The West Bank was completely integrated into Israel through building of cities and highways and industry and so forth. It became a part of the state of Israel. There was no chance for a Palestinian state to emerge, which is why Rabin and the others were willing to meet with Arafat, but only to get him to surrender, not to really come up with a peace plan. And of course, this is why it fell apart. Throughout those years, the 70s and 80s, my father, like I said, and with several other Israelis, met with Palestinian representatives, met with Yasser Arafat, and they genuinely believed that they could put together a solid peace plan that would allow the Palestinians a state and also would guarantee the rights of Palestinian Israelis or Palestinians who are citizens of Israel to equal rights. And sadly, both of these things had not happened to this day. My father passed away in 1995, and his last article was called Requiem to Oslo. He knew full well that the Oslo peace process was going to fall apart. I was not really involved with any of this other than being there when people talked about it, growing up with this. And it wasn't until September of 1997, when my sister's little girl was killed in a suicide attack in Jerusalem. She was 13 years old, and this is the kind of shock that's hard to describe in words, although I tried in the book to describe it. And after this happened, and people asked my sister particularly about revenge and retaliation, she said, well, no real mother would want to see this happen to any other mother. And in terms of who's responsible, she said, it's the Israeli government that's responsible because these two young men killed themselves or brought to a point where they could kill themselves and take the lives of others because of the brutal oppression, the occupation, and so forth, and the lack of hope and possibility when you take away people's homes and you destroy them, when you incarcerate their fathers for very long periods of time in jail, and when you shoot civilians on a regular basis, including children, then this is what happens. So I was living in the United States already at the time, and I went back trying to figure out how I'm going to approach this. And the chapter that talks about this in the book, this is the chapter that begins the journey, and it begins with the lines, my journey into Palestine began in San Diego. I was 39 years old. So I was in San Diego. That was the first time I ever met with Palestinians. Even though I grew up, I was born and raised in Jerusalem, which is a mixed city. It's a very segregated city, so I never met Palestinians, and Israelis don't meet and interact with Palestinians. And so I began this journey began with me participating in a discussion group, a dialogue group in San Diego with Palestinians. And they led me through this very difficult process of realizing that there's another story, that it's opposed to the story that I know, and it's actually, and then to the point where I realized the story that I learned was a myth, and it was not true, and then what was the story that is true? And then I began traveling into the West Bank, and I began traveling into Palestinian communities, and I realized and I learned that there was this other community, there was this other country, there was other culture and people that were living next door to me the whole time, and I had knew nothing about them. And the more I knew, the more I wanted to know, and of course, overcoming the fear and overcoming the mistrust was a big part of that. And in one part I describe my first trip, the first time I drove into the West Bank, it was to Bilayn, the village of Bilayn. It was 2005 when the protests, the popular resistance began and the weekly protests began. And as I was driving to the West Bank alone, I thought somebody's going to kill me. You know, I thought for sure that was going to be my last day on earth. Certainly it wasn't. I met people in Bilayn who I think are great heroes, and it was the beginning of a very long and excellent relationship. Today, the question that we have to ask ourselves is, where do we go from here? And again, the last chapter of the book discusses these issues. One state, two state, which is an ongoing debate. The whole issue of Zionism and so forth. And I think when we take a look at the reality, we take a look at what is going on today, we see that Israel has thousands of political prisoners, Palestinian prisoners, who are held in violation of international law. Today, there's one particular prisoner who's been on hunger strike for almost 260 days or so, Sam al-Isawi, and we have to mention him and hope and pray that he will survive this ordeal and we won't lose him. He's a great Palestinian hero. But this is a reality that Israel created. We have laws that discriminate against Palestinians who are Israeli citizens, and they live in an entirely racist and discriminatory reality. And then we have the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza who really live under the or at the mercy of the Israeli military. So how do we move on from here? I think it's important to see that Israel has created one state. Israel has integrated the West Bank completely, so we do have one state, all of Palestine, but it's a Jewish state. And the problem with that is that you can't have a Jewish state when half the population is not Jewish. Because within the boundaries of Palestine, or Israel, depending on how you call it, half the population is Israeli, but half the other half is not. We have close to 6 million Palestinians and a little in about 6.5 million Israelis, and we know it's going to grow. There will be more Palestinians than Israelis in the very near future. So the two-state solution is not going to happen. There's no situation where an Israeli government, a Zionist government, will ever allow that to happen. So the solution has to be found beyond Zionism. The solution has to be found beyond the Zionist paradigm. And that means a real democracy, a democracy with equal rights, a democracy that affords Israelis and Palestinians the same rights, the same responsibilities, a democracy that allows the release of all Palestinian prisoners, a democracy that allows for the right of return of the refugees, or at least the right of return for those who want to return and compensation for the others. I think it's important to realize many of the homes, original homes, are still standing. Many of the communities that were emptied in 1948 are still standing. The homes are often restaurants and hotels instead of homes. All that has to be resolved. But the first step would be to allow Palestinians complete equality and complete freedom, to get rid of the wall, get rid of the restrictions, get rid of the racist laws, and allow a real election where all Israelis and Palestinians go to the poll and decide as equals. I would argue that because of the similarity of the two societies, high education levels, even in the Gaza Strip, with all the restrictions and all the difficulties, education and literacy levels are over 90%, some of the highest in the world, that the engineers and the doctors and the teachers and so forth, who are now living under siege, would be able to go to work and contribute. Israel, for example, has a shortage of doctors. There are plenty of doctors, Palestinian doctors, who can do the work, and there are plenty of Palestinian doctors who are already working in Israeli hospitals. One example I like to give, it's not in the book, but it's kind of the ongoing story, the ongoing journey. My mother had surgery. She's 86 years old. She still lives in Jerusalem. She just had surgery a few months recently, and the doctor was a Palestinian. And this same wonderful young doctor who took such good care of her at Hadassah Hospital will have trouble when he wants to fly out of Tel Aviv Airport, for example, because Tel Aviv Airport is a very racist place where Palestinians are taken off to the side. All of their belongings are examined for hours. They go through body searches and strip searches and all kinds of humiliating process only because they're Palestinians, only because they're Arabs. And then at the end, they're led like criminals by the hand by a young security officer to their seat. So it's not only wrong and unjust, but it's also unsustainable. This reality, I think, is completely unsustainable. And it's not only what I think, there are others who feel that way as well. And the opening and the removal of the barriers and the removal of the barriers between the societies and allowing freedom for both Israelis and Palestinians can only help both societies, will enrich both societies. We have a situation where there's an ongoing ethnic cleansing that began 65 years ago. There's an ongoing Nakba, an ongoing catastrophe that began 65 years ago. There are still Palestinian children in refugee camps with no heating, with no heat, with no running water, with no proper nutrition. And this is only happening, it's not somewhere remote. This is not, you know, in the mountains of Afghanistan. This is an hour's drive, an hour and a half drive from major cities like Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Children don't get proper health care because in Gaza, for example, because there's not enough medicine and no proper facilities, yet they live an hour and a half from excellent facilities in Beersheba and other places. This is an ongoing catastrophe that cannot be justified, that has to be remedied. The catastrophe, I think it's important to realize, the Nakba didn't happen and stop in 1948. It's an ongoing process, and it's even worse today because it's being allowed to continue. So these children deserve a hope. They deserve hope, but whether they're in refugee camps in Lebanon or in Jordan or anywhere else or in Gaza, they deserve to be free. They deserve to live as they will, and their families deserve to go back to their homes in Palestine from which they came. And this will solve a lot of the problems. This will solve a lot of the issues that stand today. We have another issue of an ongoing de-Arabizing of the land, which is happening very rapidly. Palestine, having been an Arab country for close to 1,500 years, has monuments and names and so on that are all Arabic. But the state of Israel, because it's a racist state, because it's a racist notion, is changing the names and destroying the monuments and creating this mythical connection between the state of Israel and the ancient Hebrews, particularly King David, which is particularly ridiculous because there is no historical proof that there was a King David, yet they're trying to create a new history that connects the two, which is, of course, quite absurd. And again, going back to the discourse, this is how the discourse, people talk about this as though it's natural. In Silwan, which is a community right outside the old city of Jerusalem, someone decided that the ancient city of David is there, and so homes are being destroyed. A park is being built, an archaeological park called the City of David. Tour buses go there and see this. They see the destruction of the homes. They see the fact that Palestinians have to be removed physically from these homes. They see Israeli settlers taking over other homes in the vicinity within Silwan. It happens in broad daylight and nobody does a thing. And the fact that all of these things are happening on a regular basis, that we see these things on a regular basis, yet nothing is being done, is very serious. So I would argue that all people who care for peace and justice, all people who care for the state of Israel and for Palestinians, or I should say for Israelis and for Palestinians, need to unify behind a banner of a real equality and a democratic state, because this is the only thing that will free Palestinians, and it will also free Israelis. It will free Israelis from this racist reality in which they live. And then start discussing the bigger issues, the issues of land, the issues of water, the issues of compensation, and stop the destruction of Palestine, stop the destruction of homes. Like I said, release the prisoners. One thing that often, especially in the West, people don't realize is how important the prisoners issue is. It's said that Palestinians are some of the most incarcerated people in the world. Why is this? How is this justified? How is it justified that almost every family in Palestine has loved ones who are political prisoners, who, by the way, most of whom have not been charged with acts of violence? So these are political prisoners. And again, all of this can and should be resolved, but it's important that we all unite, all people who care about this issue. And again, they don't have to be Palestinians, they don't have to be Jews or Israelis, they just need to be people who care about peace and about justice, and work to create this transformation from the racist state that exists there today, the Zionist state of Israel, into a democracy. And there shouldn't be any fear in saying this, although the claim of anti-Semitism always comes up when somebody said this, but has nothing to do with liking or disliking Jews. Many Jews support this idea. Many Jews were not Zionists way from the very beginning, and many Jews are not Zionists today. And besides, it's the right thing to do. If we support the state of Israel, if anybody does support the state of Israel, they need to understand that they're supporting a state that has thousands of political prisoners. It's a state that is constantly bombing Gaza and other places, knowing full well they're killing civilians. It's a state that has racist laws and does not afford freedom to its own citizens because they are Palestinians, because they are not Jews. And so this is a package deal. That's what supporting Israel means. On the other hand, there's another option. And if your values tell you that equal rights and respect for civil rights and human rights is important, then the other option is the right option, and that is the option of real democracy, a democracy that protects the human rights and the civil rights of all people that live there, that guarantees a democracy, that guarantees the rights of whoever the minority might be, because it is a binational state. Hopefully it'll become a democratic binational state as opposed to what it is today, which is an apartheid and a racist binational state. And one side will obviously inevitably become the minority, but their rights should be protected under the law. And there's no reason if the wall came down tomorrow and this equality began tomorrow, that Israeli and Palestinian societies wouldn't become or form a productive democracy that would move forward and again act and bring about the real potential, bring the materialization of the real potential of Israelis and Palestinians and the real potential of this country, which has a great deal to offer, both historically and in terms of its the people and the makeup of the people and the beauty of the country. So I have to say I'm very optimistic, because I think this is a realistic proposition. It's inevitable. It's the right thing to do. And there's no question in my mind that just like apartheid fell in South Africa and non-democratic regimes fell in other places around the world, this will take place in Palestine too, and the current regime will fall, and it's in its place there will be a real democracy for Israelis and Palestinians.
That was Miko Peled, author of The General's Son, The Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. You know, it's important when we hear these personal testimonials and these personal analyses, because they carry greater power. This is not somebody just talking from the outside. This is somebody who has lived it. And the third generation in Israel, who, you know, descends from a grandfather who was one of the signers of the Declaration of the Zionist State, a father who defended it early on, and who came to appreciate the fact that there were other realities, and that caused him to examine the contradictions that even as a general he had to confront, and he confronted them. And now his son, Miko Peled, who himself was a member of the Israeli Defense Force before he quit, and is now working for, as he says, the dismantling of the Zionist state and calling attention to the inequities within that society and giving some historical perspective for it. When the United States deals with these issues, we see them dealing, you know, severing these histories from the issues that they supposedly are dealing with on a diplomatic level or an international policy level. And that is why, and in fact, it explains the U.S. Approach to dealing with apartheid in South Africa. The people who were suffering the brunt of apartheid were not real human beings. They didn't matter in the scheme of things. And it was an international groundswell that caused the issue to be put front and center, and that aided the internal struggle for democracy, if you will. That's what made it work. That's what brought an end to it. But it was a long battle even before that aspect of the struggle began. So I hope this kind of brings a different awareness to what is going on within the State of Israel, or Palestine, which was what it originally was called, and it gives a different perspective on what people are dealing with there. And in a way, it adds to the reality. This is the counterfoil to what it is we're told. You know, he talked about the different narratives. The narrative that the people of the world have is that the Arabic-speaking people are just, you know, they're just bloodthirsty people. They just want to wage war for waging war's sake. But there are issues. There are issues. And the the task in the United States, especially for those in the so-called progressive community, people who believe that there is a role to be played in how we influence the conduct of our government. I raised a question about how does the American electorate tolerate a so-called vote by the government that explicitly says that the government will be basically targeting another country's leaders for annihilation and to remove them from their democratically elected office. And that we tolerate a government that does this, and we are party to it. So now that we know, we have some ammunition to make sense of this reality that we are living in these times. I want to thank you for joining me today, and I hope that this program was in some way useful. If it is, I'd like you to let me know. In any event, I'd like you to let me know what you're thinking or what you're extracting from the programs we do here on Lead Stories. Reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or Lead Stories with Utrice Lead on Facebook. Again, Miko Peled, M-I-K-O-P-E-L-E-D. He is the author of The General's Son. It's a very interesting book that traces his own coming to terms with the duality of reality in the country in which he was born. And he discovered that he started on that path in the United States. Thanks for joining me. Stay tuned. Coming up next is The Infectious Myth with David Crowe.